Hey, everybody, and welcome to There and Back Again. I'm Alistair Stevens. Tonight, in what is sure to be an epic endeavor, in our 34th session exploring J.R.R. Tolkien's Middle-earth, we are going to pick up from the end of our departure from Lothlorien in Chapter 8 of Book 2 of The Fellowship of the Ring, then run all the way to, well, the end of the Fellowship in more than one sense. We're going to get to the breaking of the Fellowship. We're going to get to the influence of the Ring over Boromir and Frodo's difficult decision to simply walk the rest of the way into Mordor with Sam by his side. I have many, many slides tonight, but I am going to get through all of them. We may run a little longer than our usual 90 minutes tonight, but hey, that's what happens when I lag behind last week, I suppose. There's just so much material to cover, and there's an epic amount to cover in these chapters, more than I ever expected, in fact. It has been a constant surprise and delight as I've been moving through The Lord of the Rings, moving through The Hobbit too, in fact, to find more that I want to discuss, more even of value and of merit and of significance in every single chapter, on every single page of this remarkable book. And that still holds true here as we approach the end of The Fellowship of the Ring. Hello to everyone who is joining me, to Angela and to Shane and to Jenna and to Becca and to Jared. Hello in particular to Glorfin Fitz, to R. Faramir and Samuel, all of whom are joining us for the first time tonight in the live session. It is good to have you guys here. We got a lot of ground to cover. Let us waste no time at all. Let us get started with the slides that didn't make the cut into last week's session. We've got to talk about the gifts of Galadriel to the Fellowship before we depart from Lothlorien for the final time, and then move forward with purpose down the Great River. We're going to begin then with this. "Here is the gift of Celeborn and Galadriel to the leader of your company," she said to Aragorn, and she gave him a sheath that had been made to fit his sword. It was overlaid with a tracery of flowers and leaves wrought of silver and of gold, and on it were set in elven runes formed of many gems the name Andaril and the lineage of the sword. "The blade that is drawn from this sheath shall not be stained or broken, even in defeat," she said. "But is there aught else that you desire of me at our parting? For darkness will flow between us, and it may be that we shall not meet again, unless it be far hence upon a road that has no returning." And Aragorn answered, "Lady, you know all my desire, and long held in keeping the only treasure that I seek. Yet it is not yours to give me, even if you would, and only through darkness shall I come to it." "Yet maybe this will lighten your heart," said Galadriel, "for it was left in my care to be given to you should you pass through this land." And she lifted from her lap a great stone of a clear green, set in a silver brooch that was wrought in the likeness of an eagle with outspread wings. And as she held it up, the gem flashed in the sun, shining through the leaves of spring. "This stone I gave to Celeborn, my daughter, and she to hers, and now it comes to you as a token of hope. In this hour, take the name that was foretold for you, Elessar, the elf stone of the House of Elendil." Then Aragorn took the stone and pinned the brooch upon his breast, and those who saw him wondered, for they had not marked before how tall and kingly he stood, and it seemed to them that many years of toil had fallen from his shoulders. "For the gifts that you have given me, I thank you," he said. "O Lady of Lorien, of whom were sprung Celeborn and Arwen Evenstar, what praise could I say more?" The lady bowed her head, and she turned then to Boromir, and to him she gave a belt of gold, and to Merry and Pippin she gave small silver belts, each with a clasp wrought like a golden flower. To Legolas she gave a bow such as the Galadhrim used, longer and stouter than the bows of Mirkwood, and strung with a string of elf hair. With it went a quiver of arrows. So we can start at the end here. Legolas gets a bow. Merry and Pippin get their small silver belts. To Boromir, she gives a belt of gold, as befits his stature. But really, the gifts that we're paying closest attention to here are the gifts that she gives to Aragorn. "Elf hair," says Lynn. Yeah, that's a detail that always feels a little odd to me too. But I guess what else would you use to string a bow of Lothlorien, right? What else is suitably enchanted that it could be used to string such a bow? Legolas is going to do great good with that bow in the pages to come, so presumably it is a valuable gift for her kinsmen from the north. But as I say, we're really focused on Aragorn here. He gets his sheath for his blade, and of course, there is a certain irony in what Galadriel has to say. "The blade that is drawn from the sheath shall not be stained or broken, even in defeat," she says, firstly acknowledging, yes, we are still fighting the long defeat. This is not a gift of victory for you. This is not an assurance of victory. This is not a guarantee of any kind. But even if you fall, the sword that was broken and reforged shall not be broken again. And there is, of course, even an element of grave import there too. Even if you fail, your sword will remain. Your sword will endure. There will be no one in your lineage in generations to come who can reforge your blade. If you fall, if this whole thing goes badly, which it probably will, you guys, if this whole thing goes badly, we are done. This is the final battle against the great foe. But much more importantly, she gives him a token that means more to him than even Anduril, even the Flame of the West, even the sword that was broken and reforged. "Maybe this will lighten your heart," said Galadriel, "for it was left in my care to be given to you should you pass through this land. This is the great stone of a clear green." This is the... Well, okay. Firstly, we note that Aragorn is standing more tall and kingly than he has before, or at least both his height and his kingliness, and those two things are not completely, you know, disconnected from one another in concept there. But these things are more emphasized to those who look upon him. And we're reminded, of course, of Rivendell. Do you remember Aragorn's inclusion in Bilbo's song about Arendelle? Arendelle was a mariner. After Bilbo has recited that poem in the House of Elrond, people are wondering, well, what parts were yours and what parts were Aragorn's and who wrote what? And Bilbo tells Frodo, well, Aragorn only added one thing, that he should wear a green gem upon his breast an emerald. That was the line that Aragorn wanted to be included in the Arendelle poem. And now, well, here he is, wearing a green stone upon his own breast, a symbol of Arwen, a symbol of his love, the symbol, the token that he wants, that is his heart's desire, but he knows that it's not in Galadriel's power to give to him directly. But here she can give it to him indirectly, not as a token of her own, but as a token of Arwen's. Arwen has left this in Galadriel's care just in case. It's really quite beautiful. "This stone I gave to Celebrion, my daughter, and she to hers." That is Arwen. Celebrion is Galadriel's daughter and Elrond's wife. She is the elf woman of whom almost nothing is told. I can hardly ever remember her name, in fact. But she is Arwen's mother. "This stone I gave to Celebrion, my daughter, and she to hers. And now it comes to you as a token of hope. In this hour, take the name that was foretold for you, Elessar, the elf stone of the House of Elendil." Well, Aragorn is, of course, of the House of Elendil. He is the descendant of Isildur. Isildur was Elendil's son. This is the royal line of both Gondor and Arnor, as we'll discuss in the pages to come. And Elessar is the name that Aragorn was known by when he was staying at Rivendell. And in Sindarin, Elessar means hope. And he will ultimately take that as his name when he ascends the throne at the end of the book. Let me see as I catch up here. Yes, also a great Tolkien name, says Jackie. Yes, absolutely. "Elven hair is the best for bowstrings," says Angela. "Strong and magical for a true shot, and it sings instead of things when the arrow is released, at least I imagine." I like that. I like that quite a lot. Good. Good. So that is our first gift. This is the great gift that she gives to Aragorn. A sheath for his sword. Perfect. A kingly gift, in fact, and respectful of the lineage of this great sword. But that's not all. She also gives this token of Arwen. And he compliments her. "For the gifts you have given me, I thank you. A lady of Lorien, of whom were sprung Celebrion and Arwen Evenstar, what praise could I say more? How can I praise you more than to say that you are the mother of these fine women? That you are the grandmother, in particular, of Arwen. Arwen of the Twilight. Arwen, who is the most beautiful elf to live in these times. One of the most beautiful women to have ever lived. And this beacon of elvendom here in the twilight passing of their people. It's a genuinely beautiful moment. Though not even the most beautiful moment that we get in this passage, because we're going to move on to the gift to Gimli. "For you, little gardener and lover of trees," she said to Sam, "I have only a small gift." She put into his hand a little box of plain grey wood, unadorned save for a single silver rune upon the lid. "Here is set G for Galadriel," she said, "but also it may stand for garden in your tongue. In this box there is earth from my orchard and such blessing as Galadriel has still to bestow is upon it. It will not keep you against any peril. But if you keep it and see your home again at last, then perhaps it may reward you. That you should find all barren and laid waste. There will be few gardens in Middle-earth that will bloom like your garden, if you sprinkle this earth there. Then you may remember Galadriel, and catch a glimpse of far-off Lorien that you have seen only in our winter. For our spring and our summer are gone by, and they will never be seen on earth again, save in memory." Sam went red to the ears and muttered something inaudible as he clutched the box and bowed as well as he could. And what gift would a dwarf ask of the elves? Said Galadriel, turning to Gimli.
None, lady, answered Gimli. It is enough for me to have seen the Lady of the Galadhrim and to have heard her gentle words.
Hear all ye elves, she cried to those about her. Let none say again that dwarves are grasping and ungracious. It surely, Gimli, son of Glowin, you desire something that I could give? Name it, I bid you. You shall not be the only guest without a gift.
That is nothing, Lady Galadriel, said Gimli, bowing low and stammering. Nothing, unless it is permitted to ask, nay, to name a single strand of your hair which surpasses the gold of the earth as the stars surpass the gems of the mine. I do not ask for such a gift, but you commanded me to name my desire.
The elf stirred and murmured with astonishment, and Celeborn gazed at the dwarf in wonder, but the lady smiled.
It is said that the skill of the dwarves is in their hands rather than in their tongues, she said, and that is not true of Gimli, for none have ever made to me a request so bold and yet so courteous.
And how shall I refuse since I commanded him to speak? But tell me, what would you do with such a gift?
Treasure it, lady, he answered, in memory of your words to me at our first meeting. And if ever I return to the smithies of my home, it shall be set in an imperishable crystal to be an heirloom of my house and a pledge of goodwill between the mountain and the wood until the end of days.
Well, let's deal with Sam first. What gift could be more appropriate to Sam than this little box of the Earth of Lorien? What gift could be more appropriate to the gardener than the gift of the garden? The gift of Lorien itself, even in its winter, even in its fading, it shall surpass all other mortal gardens. And we see how this touches Sam. And yet, even in the gift, as was in the gift to Aragorn too, there is a hint here of doom on the horizon. There is a hint here of the shadow falling across Middle-earth. Though you should find all barren and laid waste, there will be few gardens in Middle-earth that will bloom like your garden if you sprinkle this earth there. Though you should find all barren and laid waste. This is semantically ambiguous. Though you should means even if you do. But it also means though you will. It means both of these things. And of course, we know that Sam has already had this vision of the Shire. He's seen Ted Sandeman tearing down the trees on the Old Mill Road. He's seen his gaffer turned out of his house on Bagshot Row. We know that things are going badly in the Shire. Something will need to be done. Though you should find all barren and laid waste, there will be few gardens in Middle-earth that will bloom like your garden if you sprinkle this earth there. A memory of Lorien. And of course, now Sam is given the gift that he has sought since the second chapter of this book. Elves, sir. Now he himself, more so than Galadriel, we know what Galadriel is going to do. We know that she has passed her test. She will diminish and go into the West and remain Galadriel. We know now that however the war against Sauron turns out, however the War of the Ring ends, Lothlorien will fall. It will fade. But she is entrusting to Sam a kind of perpetuity. A kind of future here. She is giving the gift of Lorien itself, which has meant so much to her. This land over which she has governed, this land that she has preserved, this land that she has created and watched over for 1,000 years, she is now passing on to Sam. And it is very tempting to read that in a couple of different ways. Obviously, she is touched by Sam's simple virtue, his simple heroism. This is absolutely an appropriate gift for Sam Gamgee. But it is more than that. This is the passing of a torch, the passing of the torch of memory from the elder children of Iluvatar to the youngest children of Iluvatar. This is the passing of the torch from elves to mortals, in effect. And we know that Sam will treasure it, and we know that Sam will use it wisely. And then we get the gift of the hair. Let's actually look at the giving of the gift itself. Then the lady unbraided one of her long tresses and cut off 3 golden hairs and laid them in Gimli's hand. These words shall go with the gift, she said. I do not foretell, for all foretelling is now vain. On the one hand lies darkness, and on the other only hope. But if hope should not fail, then I say to you, Gimli, son of Glowin, that your hands shall flow with gold, and yet over you gold shall have no dominion. And you, Ringbearer, she said, turning to Frodo, I come to you last, who are not last in my thoughts. For you I have prepared this. She held up a small crystal phial. It glittered as she moved it, and rays of white light sprang from her hand. In this phial, she said, is caught the light of Arendelle's star, set amid the waters of my fountain. It will shine still brighter when night is about you,
May it be a light to you in dark places when all other lights go out. Remember Galadriel and her mirror." Frodo took the phial, and for a terrible moment as it shone between them, he saw her again standing like a queen, great and beautiful, but no longer terrible. He bowed, but found no words to say. The giving of the hair to Gimli is a kind of joke. The reason that Celeborn and the other elves are so aghast is that actually Galadriel has kind of a previous record here. And this is Tolkien having fun with himself. He's having fun with his own legendarium here, because there is no way that the reader of The Fellowship of the Ring, as it was published, could have any sense of the story behind this. But Galadriel has refused the gift of her hair before. She has refused the gift of her hair no less than three times, and she refused it to Feanor, to the spirit of fire himself, to the crafter and creator of the Silmarils. He asked her again and again. He created the Silmarils in part inspired by Galadriel's hair and asked her for a single strand of her hair, and she refused him three times, and now she yields it to Gimli. And that is, of course, indicative of the passing of time. It is, of course, indicative of Galadriel's pride, you know, that her pride is now broken in the most positive and healthy of ways. Her pride is now set aside. She has passed her test. And her test, in one way or another, was always pride. The test of the Noldor was always pride. And she has passed. So now there is no reason to be prideful. Now there is no reason to withhold this gift. But she gives it for more than virtue. She gives it more. She gives it for reasons other than her passing the test. This isn't just an act of kindness and largesse, which would be expected. She asks him what he is going to do with it. And he says, "Well, I'll treasure it, of course. This, you commanded me to tell you my desire. I have told you my desire. I'm not asking for this thing." He's very clear. "This is not what I'm asking for, but I'm, you know, obeying the instruction that you gave me. But if you give these to me, I will take them. I will set them within imperishable crystal, and there will be an heirloom of my family. They will be passed down, and they will signify and kindle a new friendship between the mountain and the wood. They are, even in the act of giving, a symbol of hope." Gimli coming to Lothlorien in the first place is a symbol of hope. It is a symbol of renewal. It is a symbol of the old ways being reasserted, reestablished. And how has this happened? Why has this happened? What was it that drove the elves and the dwarves apart in the first place? Well, there are numerous things. There are numerous points of conflict between the elves and the dwarves, and Tolkien never really pinned down everything that was wrong between the elves and the dwarves to a single kind of event. But we've talked about Nimrodal, and we've talked about the rising of Durin's Bane within Khazad-dûm. We've talked about the coming of the Great Darkness. The dwarves delved too deep in the Dwarodelph. They found and awoke this ancient evil, and when that ancient evil awoke, the elves started to flee. And we talked about this with the Nimrodal poem. We talked about Cairn Amroth. When we were on Cairn Amroth, we talked about Amroth, the king of Lothlorien, who then departs because he's done. He's done. Yes, he wants to marry Nimrodal. Absolutely. And Nimrodal wants to flee because of Durin's Bane. But they're not the only ones. The elves in large number departed this part of the world because of the rise of evil within Khazad-dûm. And it is no coincidence that that evil has now been dealt with. That evil has now been slain. It cost us Gandalf. He fell in the battle, but Durin's Bane is dead. The great shadow that poured forth from the gates of Moria has been vanquished now. And it's easy, I think, to kind of stumble a little bit when we use the term shadow to describe the influence of evil in Tolkien's legendarium, which is a recurring theme from Melkor onward. The shadow is used as a symbol of evil and the influence of evil. And it's easy to kind of take that as a simple bit of transposition here. You know, we use the shadow because it sounds dark and cool, and that's why. But it really is a shadow. The shadow that falls is not about the direct influence of the evil. It is a natural consequence of the evil. The light is no longer unimpeded. The light of hope and of love and of kinship and of fellowship is no longer unimpeded. So darkness is more than just more than just the direct action of the enemy. It is more than just the direct action of Melkor or of Sauron or of Saruman or of Durin's Bane, of the Balrog. It is more than just the direct influence. It is the kind of concomitant influence of these things. But now the shadow has gone and the light can shine again. And this is Lothlorien and this is Galadriel and this is the work of J.R.R. Tolkien. So, of course, the victory here is tragic. The coming of the light, the return of the light to Lothlorien is tragic because now we know it is going to fade. It is going to fade naturally. It is going to fade as it was always supposed to fade, even in the spirit of you know, Galadriel's remarkable and well, we can talk about the morality of her decision to preserve Lothlorien in this unnatural state. But that unnatural state has now ended and will end one way or the other, right? She has passed her test on one hand, so there's that. But now, if Frodo wins, then the One Ring is destroyed and the three Elven Rings will lose their power. And without Nenya, not even Galadriel can preserve Lothlorien anymore. It is very clear that this entire woodland realm is preserved through the influence of the Elven Ring upon her finger. That's done now. And of course, if Frodo doesn't win, if the One Ring isn't destroyed, well, then Lothlorien is going to burn. The entire world is going to burn. So one way or another, things are bad. All that we can hope for, the best thing that we can wish for at this point, is the natural fading into memory, into remembrance, the passing of the elves into from the world, the passing of the elves into myth, the sailing. Let me catch up here. Kristen asks, oh my goodness, I've never thought of this. Now I'm suddenly wondering if anyone has ever written fanfiction where Gimli meets Feanor. We're going to have to check for that one. That would be magnificent. I certainly hope that someone has. If no one has, then someone should. Had I a gift for fanfiction, I would definitely get on that one myself, yes. Let me see as I scroll. If Feanor were grown in these millennia, he'd be thinking, Gimli's a better man than I. Well given, says R. Faramir here in the chat. I hope that's true. I really do. I'm not sure that Feanor, at least at the height of his arrogance, would be quite so magnanimous about this gift, but I hope that that's true. Yeah. Yeah. Jared says, boy, this sounds like a lesson for humanity that could have been written last week. They're putting aside their differences and showing respect and honor. I completely agree. I think that, gosh, it's so powerful. It's so important. The perspective that we get, again, this is the counterpoint to the trivially discarded notion that Tolkien only writes about good and evil, that the good guys wear white and the bad guys wear black. And that's, you know, just this morally simplistic landscape. That's the conflict between good and evil that we get in the pages of Tolkien. Set that aside. Absolutely set that aside. Nothing is as simple as that. And gosh, isn't it appropriate that we're talking about that right before we talk about Boromir? Tolkien Lover is joining us tonight. Tolkien Lover, it is great to see you. If Melkor had made the One Ring, could Sauron still use it, or would it be too powerful? Gosh, what an interesting question. I would think that Sauron could use it. Okay. We must think of it in these terms. Let me cancel the slide and actually come back to you. I wasn't planning on canceling the slide tonight because I thought I'd just have slides up the whole time, but hey, here we are. Sauron creates the ring and imbues it with a fraction of his power because that is what evil folk do. Evil folk break the white light, as Saruman has, right? Saruman has broken the white light. He is now Saruman of many colors because he believes in his ignorance that that gives him power. The understanding of the thing, the mastery over the thing, increases his power. It, of course, does not. Sauron has embodied his power in the One Ring, in all the rings, in fact, and thereby corrupts those who wear them, corrupts those who wield them. Melkor did a very similar trick way, way back in the day. He would imbue his followers with a fraction of his own power, which in the end actually left him weaker than the other Valar. That is why Melkor couldn't contend with the other Valar, because he had distributed his power. So it is true to say that though Melkor didn't craft the One Ring and give it to Sauron, he did imbue Sauron with his power. So I would suspect that had Melkor crafted the ring, that Sauron could have borne it, but would have been all the more corrupted by it. You know, the process of corruption that Sauron went through, and we must remember that Sauron himself is corrupted. He was of the Maiar. He fell under Melkor's shadow and was corrupted by it. That corruption would have been all the more absolute. He would have been, gosh, all the more powerful, all the more terrifying, I'm sure. Though, at the same time, it's probably true to say, too, that Melkor would have been all the more easily and readily defeated, because fracturing your own power in this act of flawed and arrogant faux creation, you know, the reason that evil forces do this is that they cannot create. They cannot make new things. They do not have that power within them, because the power to create is Ilúvatar's, and Ilúvatar's alone. That shines through us. We refract that into lights of different colors, and that is the kind of the mechanism of the creative act. But because evil beings are cut off from that light, they can't create. So instead of transmitting that white light of creation, they tear from themselves portions of their own presence, portions of their own power, and imbue things with that, and yet are still driven to create, right? Because they're still a part of the world. The notion of creativity is still present within them, even though they are disconnected from the mechanism of creativity. So I would suspect, yes, Sauron could wear the ring. It would have been even worse. It would have been, hoo boy, all the worse. As John says, portions of their own shadow, in a way. Yes, that's very good. Let me scroll back here. There was a question from yes. Oh, this is good. This is a question from Johnny of Johnny's Virtual Journeys. Philosophical question. When does light magic cross the line into dark? Well, you know what? I think that's a very good question for us to bear in mind as we move forward through this reading tonight, because we are going to get in the fall of Boromir, and I'm hesitating about that only because, of course, Boromir's circumstances are a little more complicated than that. Actually, okay, we're not going to get to it this week, because we're not going to get to it until we get Aragorn's final words to Boromir at the beginning of The Two Towers. But to jump ahead, Aragorn tells Boromir, no, you didn't fail. You passed. You passed the test. You passed the test as surely as Galadriel did. You fell under the influence of the ring, and then you rejected it. And how many people have done that? So where does light cross into dark? Where does good fall under a shadow? Where does it become perverted and corrupted? Let's keep an eye on that as we move through the rest of tonight's reading, which we absolutely must do right now, because, yeah, well, yes, Jackie's referencing pride here. Yes, I think it crosses the line in Tolkien's world when it becomes about pride and power. Pride is absolutely significant, yes. Although, it is not Boromir's pride per se that breaks him. It is not Boromir's pride. The ring works on his pride, but his pride as it is presented to us is not an entirely bad thing. Aragorn is, well, is he prideful? No, he is confident and assured, I suppose. We're going to get into a semantic discussion about the meaning of the word pride, and we're already a half hour into tonight's session, so let's keep going. Jared asks, in Tolkien's world, is the same magic used by both good and evil, a la the Force, or is it something else? We don't No, basically, we don't. Tolkien studiously avoids giving us a real insight into what magic is and how it operates. Gandalf doesn't cast spells. As we looked when we were back in Moria, which is the passage, I think, where we get the clearest kind of explanation of this, when he is casting spells, when he is talking in the elven tongue and magic is occurring as a result, he's commanding the world around him, but these are not secret and arcane words. He's just speaking in the old tongue. He is drawing upon some power that is apparently contained within him, but also apparently contained within the world. He talks to the world around him, and we might contrast that or complement that with a perspective on Tom Bombadil, for example, whose power seems to be drawn from his little kingdom, you know? We might even, you know, turn to Smaug and turn to Sauron and look at the devastations which surround Erebor in the pages of The Hobbit, and which have, you know, completely destroyed Mordor at this point in the narrative, or much of Mordor at this point in the narrative, and we can look at that devastation and we can say, okay, there's some kind of environmental resonance here. We are drawing on something, right? We're drawing on something that is present in the world around us, and we are channeling that, we are directing that, we are evoking that. Magic does seem to be constantly connected to the world, and we get that in a myriad different ways. You know, we get that the influence of the elves. Here in Lothlorien, we have the presence of elven magic that is tied very much to the environment. On the other side of the Misty Mountains, in Holland, we have the memory of elves. The memory of elves still endures, and the land is wholesome. The land is peaceful. It is restorative to those of good heart who pass through it. We see that in Rivendell. We see that of a sort in the Shire, too. Magic seems to be in part derived from the land, but coupled with a knowledge, yes, the way that the wizards in particular talk about magic, the way that the great elves talk about magic, absolutely suggests that knowledge is vital. Understanding the world without, crucially, breaking it, understanding the world opens the doors to magical potential here. But the actual mechanism by which we cast spells, we just have no idea. I mean, we have a few instances where, you know, Gandalf's staff is clearly important. It is a magical artifact in and of itself. The Elven Rings we know to be important. They are magical artifacts. The Arkenstone is of dubious magical value. We talked about that back in the pages of The Hobbit. So there are magical artifacts, but exactly how they work too, we just don't know. This is something that Tolkien deliberately wanted to leave ambiguous. He wanted to create a space for speculation so that it felt magical, right? Because what we see in modern fantasy, what we see under the influence of Dungeons and Dragons, the great influence of Gary Gygax back in the 1970s, what we see in a complete taxonomic index of magic is the transformation of magic into science. If it can be pinned down and studied, if its effects are absolutely replicable, if it is a reliable means of harnessing some kind of potent natural energy in the world in which you find yourself, in the fantasy realm in which you dwell, then it's just a kind of science. Magic in that regard is like electromagnetism or like gravity. It is something that can be understood and channeled and harnessed, and that's it. But Tolkien, speaking as he was to the older fairy tale tradition, wanted to keep magic magical. He wanted it to be inexplicable. He wanted it to be something sorcerous, something fantastical, something awe-inspiring, awesome in both the older and the more modern senses of the word. And for my money, I mean, he's completely achieved that, I think. And the closer we get to magic, the more magic we see directly, the more we understand it, the more we think about it, the more I think that is true, the more it holds up. A superficial read says, absolutely, Gandalf is a 14th level mage. He can cast these spells once per day. We've seen his amazing fireworks. That's probably some derivation of the magic missile attack. He can do fireballs, he can do levitation, he can do this, that, and the other. That's not what it is. To be a wizard is not to be possessed of that kind of, you know, index of spell cards. That's not what being a user of magic is about. It is about enchantment, I guess. Which is one of the reasons I think that Tolkien actually leaned away from using the word magic as much as possible. You know, other characters will use magic, but Gandalf and those of the wise will talk less often about magic, yeah. Let me see here. Jenna says, yes, magic in Tolkien does not bother me as much as in other books. Harry Potter, yes. Oh, R. Faramir, this is beautiful. Twisting Clark's third law here. If your technology is distinguishable from magic, it is insufficiently advanced. I like that very much. And Nikki, yes, Nikki's calling out Earthsea. So the type of magic is like the magic in Tales of Earthsea, utilizing magic by the naming of the true name of things, thus harnessing the magic. Yes, and in the works of Ursula K. Le Guin, in the Earthsea series, the knowledge of the name of something is kind of is biblical in its meaning. That is to say that it's not just about the name of something. I mean, it oftentimes is about the name of something, but knowing the name of something is a key to understanding its true nature, and it is the understanding as represented by the name that unlocks the ability to perform magic. Yeah, we're definitely going to look at A Wizard of Earthsea after we're done with Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban, because it is just, the more that I think about it, and believe me, I think about it a lot, particularly in the context of Harry Potter and in the context of The Lord of the Rings, the more I think about A Wizard of Earthsea in particular, the first book of the series, that the more I think that it is uncommonly sophisticated and uncommonly influential. It is rarely included on when you're thinking about, you know, contemporary Western high fantasy or contemporary Western low fantasy. If you're thinking about the works of like R. Scott Baker, or you're thinking about the works of George R. R. Martin or Patrick Rothfuss, you know, or Brandon Sanderson, you know, when you're thinking about Western fantasy, we think of Tolkien and we think of the inheritors of that tradition, you know, explicitly. We don't often think of Ursula K. Le Guin, and we really, really should, particularly with the works of R. Scott Baker. Okay, I'm getting distracted. You're all just distracting me from talking about the slides. Let's keep pushing on into our next chapter. Here, let me share the slide with you. So many buttons to click in this new interface, and I'll put the focus on that so that you can see it at a reasonable size. Here we go. Okay, so now we're moving into chapter 9. We're traveling down river. We're going to spend a lot of time in this chapter traveling down river, and we're going to cover a lot of ground. We'll take a glance at the map later just to see how far we travel in this time. Frodo was roused by Sam. He found that he was lying well wrapped under tall, gray-skinned trees in a quiet corner of the woodlands on the west bank of the great river Anduin. He had slept the night away, and the grey of morning was dim among the bare branches. Gimli was busy with a small fire near at hand. They started again before the day was broad. Not that most of the company was eager to hurry southwards. They were content that the decision, which they must make at latest when they came to Rorus and the Tindrook Isle, still lay some days ahead. And they let the river bear them on at its own pace, having no desire to hasten toward the perils that lay beyond, whichever course they took in the end. Aragorn let them drift with the stream as they wished, husbanding their strength against weariness to come. But he insisted that at least they should start early each day and journey on far into the evening, for he felt in his heart that time was pressing, and he feared that the Dark Lord had not been idle while they lingered in Lorien. Nonetheless, they saw no sign of any enemy that day nor the next. The dull grey hours passed without event. As the third day of their voyage wore on, the lands changed slowly. The trees thinned and then failed altogether. On the eastern bank to their left, they saw long, formless slopes stretching up and away toward the sky. Brown and withered they looked, as if fire had passed over them, leaving no living blade of green, an unfriendly waste without even a broken tree or a bold stone to relieve the emptiness. They had come to the brown lands that lay vast and desolate between southern Mirkwood and the hills of the Emyn Mool. What pestilence or war or evil deed of the enemy had so blasted all that region? Even Aragorn could not tell. Though Aragorn is right in the implicit supposition here that it was in fact an act of the enemy that devastated the Brown Lands back in the days of the Last Alliance, back before the final battle at which Sauron fell to Isildur. Sauron did in fact ravage this land with fire, and it has never yet been restored. A reminder that we are living in a fallen world. We're passing south out of Lothlorien, out of this little bubble of preservation here in Lothlorien, back into the real world. And I'm always struck here, as we're drifting downriver in our little elven boats, boats of elven make, we're husbanding our strength against the perils to come. But they just spent literally a month in Lothlorien. Are they not feeling revitalized? Are they not ready now for the road ahead? They have lingered long in Lothlorien and been restored as people who visit with the elves are restored. We've seen that, gosh, countless times, from Rivendell back in the pages of The Hobbit to our encounter with Gildor, our return to Rivendell in The Lord of the Rings. We've seen even our time spent in Holin and then our emergence from Moria, the crossing of the Nimrodel. The crossing of the Nimrodel itself restores the Fellowship. They're feeling better after splashing through those cool and restorative waters. But now something is different. Now something is changed in them. And though they're not in a hurry, they're also kind of guarding their strength. They're recovering, in a sense. It feels to me as though they are recovering. And I wonder to what degree that is a consequence of leaving Lothlorien. Because the time that we spent with Gildor, the time that we spent with Rivendell, and Rivendell, of course, being the most mundane of the magical realms here, compared to Lothlorien, Rivendell is the prancing pony. You know, it is completely normal. It is a completely expected and familiar environment compared to Lothlorien. But in Lothlorien, we have ventured into fairy proper. I mean, almost fairy proper. The only way that we could go more into fairy is if we take the straight road into the west and we go to the Undying Lands, we go to Valinor. That's not something that anyone in this party can do right now or has done before. So that's outside of the realm of our experience. But coming through Moria, the completely mundane realm of Moria, mundane not in the sense that it isn't fantastical, but mundane in the sense that it is at least natural. It is not imbued with elven magic. It is not of fairy. We've spent now a month in Lothlorien, and I wonder to what degree each of our companions, each of our travelers here has been worn by that, because spending time in fairy is dangerous. It's not just dangerous because it's seductive, though it certainly is that. But in fairy stories, those who venture forth into fairy almost never return unchanged. And if they do, by some miracle, return unchanged, they find that the world has changed around them. And we get slight inferences toward that. We're going to It's a half dozen slides from now. But Sam is actually going to note the moon and think, hey, how long did we spend in Lorien? And we foreshadowed that in last week's discussion. They were in Lothlorien for a month, even though to them it feels like a few days. So I wonder to what degree they are feeling the elven hangover of hanging out in Lothlorien for all of that time. So from there, we travel still further south. How wide and empty and mournful all this country looks, said Frodo. I always imagined that as one journeyed south, it got warmer and merrier until winter was left behind forever. But we have not journeyed far south yet, answered Aragorn. It is still winter, and we are far from the sea. Here the world is cold until the sudden spring, and we may yet have snow again. Far away down in the Bay of Belfalas, to which the Anduin runs, it is warm and merry, maybe, or would be, but for the enemy. But here we are not above 60 leagues, I guess, south of the South Farthing away in your shire, hundreds of long miles yonder. You are looking now southwest across the north plains of the Riddermark, Rohan, the land of the horse lords. Ere long we shall come to the mouth of the Limlight that runs down from Fangorn to join the great river. That is the north boundary of Rohan, and of old, all that lay between Limlight and the White Mountains belonged to the Rohirrim. It is a rich and pleasant land, and its grass has no rival, but in these evil days folk do not dwell by the river or ride often to its shores. Anduin is wide, yet the orcs can shoot their arrows far across the stream, and of late, it is said, they have dared to cross the water and raid the herds and studs of Rohan. Sam looked from bank to bank uneasily. The trees had seemed hostile before, as if they had harbored secret eyes and lurking dangers. Now he wished that the trees were still there. He felt that the company was too naked, afloat in little open boats in the midst of shelterless lands and on a river that was the frontier of war. As you've no doubt observed during our exploration of Tolkien's Middle-earth, I have a real affection for these passages in which characters lay out the geography to each other. We've had that a few times from Aragorn. We got that around Weathertop. That was pretty good. That was pretty strong. My favorite that we've had so far is the conversation between Gimli and Gandalf about, you know, Carathras and the three peaks above Khazad-dûm, when we get the three names in common and in Dwarven and in Elvish too. That's one of my favorites. And then when we emerge, of course, into the Vale of Azanulbazar, when we emerge down the Dimrill Stair into the Dimrill Dale, we can see the expanse of the landscape ahead of us. It all very good. Oh, going back to The Hobbit, you know, just remembering the way that Bilbo would describe the landscapes that we got. This is one of my favorite things that Tolkien does, and is, I think, a consequence of Tolkien's skill as a painter of landscapes. He sees the landscape very clearly. He sees the landscape. He sees the entire geography very, very clearly, and it matters a great deal to him. If you delve into Christopher Tolkien's epic History of Middle-earth series, you can see Tolkien fighting with the geography. You can see him revising the geography, kind of making the geography fit the story and making the story fit the geography. And sometimes the narrative takes precedence, and sometimes just the vision that he has of the world takes precedence, and he will warp the story around it. I'm always so inspired by the way that Tolkien handles this stuff. It's just infinitely inspiring to me. Let me see here as I scroll down. Yes, as Angela says, they're still recovering from the loss of Gandalf too, and it's clear that they can't decide what to do next. Yeah, it's so difficult for them now to look ahead. What are some modern day uses for Elven Hangover, asks Jared. God, I guess you just have to spend some time in Faerie, I suppose, right? I mean, I suppose the closest thing that you can come to... I don't know if you would get a hangover from drinking elven adult beverages, from drinking elven spirits, elven wine. I'm not sure if a hangover would be, you know, a necessary consequence of that. But I think that from spending time, you know, sometimes when you're in intoxicating company, right? It may be a date, or it may be a party, it may be a dinner party, it may be some kind of environment when you're just with people and the air is abuzz with joy and vibrancy and you're connected. And when you start to feel just a little bit maybe outside of your body in those moments, when you feel like everything is just working out and you feel smarter and sharper and more charismatic than you normally do, I think that moment when you know, close the door, when your guests depart and you close the door and you have that little, that I think may be an elven hangover. I don't know how widely applicable that is, but if it's not widely applicable in your life, then it should be. You need to, you know, hang out with better and more awesome people. For example, every Thursday night, as we discuss The Lord of the Rings in There and Back Again. Yes, the river is the frontier of war, Jackie reminds us. Remember, Gladden Fields is just a ways north of where they are. Yes, in fact, Let me call up my old friends here at the Lord of the Rings project. I can show you, if I can make this work reliably, which I'm having some trouble with here. There we are. All right. And I need to disable the events thing here because that's frustrating. There we are. Okay. Let me take this and put it up here in the screen. Just getting the whole unexpurgated, you know, awfulness here. Okay, so here we can see the Mines of Moria. We can see Miramir and we can see Lorien. We came down, kind of down the Silverload, kind of. We actually came down south of there. We crossed the Nimrodel to Karas Galadhon, which you can see right there, actually using its older spelling, Karas Galadhon. Tolkien went back and forth whether it was a D or a DH in Galadhon, but it should be a DH because it seems as though it was always supposed to be pronounced Galadhon. There is that Anglo-Saxon DH-TH kind of comparison there. And now we are sailing south. So we are here at this point, somewhere around this curve, I guess, of the Field of Celebrant. Oh, and to get to Jackie's point, yes, the Gladden Fields are up here in the north, just to the west of Mirkwood here. So now we're coming down, we're crossing, presumably we're somewhere in this bend because we haven't yet reached the Limelight at this point. Here we see the brown lands extending on the east, the infinite expanse of brown lands here on the east. We have the Wold here on the west, which is the northern limit of Rohan, as you can see here. Then we have the Gap of Rohan all on the west, and we're going to pass all the way down toward this significant lake right here that we're going to talk about a little more when we get there. Again, huge shout out to the Lord of the Rings project, lotrproject.com. This is a fantastic map. Go and lose an hour there just anytime you're distracted. Anytime you should be working, really, you can go and spend an hour there. All right, let me close that up and get back to our slides. Let's keep pushing on here. Between this slide and the next slide, we have the beat where Sam observes the log with glowing eyes, which is following them. And I'm always charmed in that description. I didn't pull the slide, but I'm always so charmed during that description how much Tolkien could be, or let me parse that more carefully, how much Sam could almost be describing a crocodile or an alligator. There's a log with large eyes following us, with weird paddle feet kind of coming off the side of it. It almost feels as though he could be misinterpreting what he sees, but of course he isn't. Frodo knows exactly what is happening. Let's push on here. In the dead hours, Frodo came out of a deep, dark sleep to find Sam shaking him. "It's a shame to wake you," whispered Sam. "But that's what you said. There's nothing to tell, or not much. I thought I heard some soft plashing and a sniffing noise a while back, but you hear a lot of such queer sounds by a river at night." He lay down, and Frodo sat up, huddled in his blankets, and fought off his sleep. Minutes or hours passed slowly, and nothing happened. Frodo was just yielding to the temptation to lie down again when a dark shape, hardly visible, floated close to one of the moored boats. A long, whitish hand could be dimly seen as it shot out and grabbed the gunwale. Two pale, lamp-like eyes shone coldly as they peered inside, and then they lifted up and gazed up at Frodo on the edge. They were not more than a yard or two away, and Frodo heard the soft hiss of intaken breath. He stood up, drawing Sting from its sheath, and faced the eyes. Immediately, their light was shut off. There was another hiss and a splash, and the dark log shape shot away downstream into the night. Aragorn stirred in his sleep, turned over, and sat up. "What is it?" he whispered, springing up and coming to Frodo. "I felt something in my sleep. Why have you drawn your sword?" "Gollum," answered Frodo. "Or at least, so I guess." "Ah," said Aragorn. "So you know about our little footpad, do you? He paddled after us all through Moria and right down to Nimrodel. Since we took to boats, he's been lying on a log and paddling with hands and feet. I've tried to catch him once or twice at night, but he is slyer than a fox and as slippery as a fish. I hope the river voyage would beat him, but he is too clever a waterman. We shall have to try going faster tomorrow. You lie down now, and I will keep watch for what is left of the night. I wish I could lay my hands on the wretch. We might make him useful. But if I cannot, we shall have to try and lose him. He is very dangerous, quite apart from murder by night on his own account. He may put any enemy that is about on our track." "Doesn't take much to wake the ranger," says Jackie. And Shane says, "It's funny how Aragorn is so chill about being followed." Yes. Nikki says, "Aragorn is the one commodity I would take if I were stranded on an island." Wait, are we allowed to do that? Is that a thing that we're allowed to do? We're just allowed to take Aragorn, son of Arathorn, with us? It's pretty good. It's a pretty good choice. If you had to be stranded on a desert island with a character from The Lord of the Rings, who would you take? The obvious answer is Sam, right? Well, I guess it depends. Are you there to be comfortable, or are you there to get off the island? Because possibly taking, you know, Gwaihir, taking the King of the Eagles might be, you know, also an appropriate response. You could take Beorn. I mean, he'd probably be pretty comfortable, right? Jenna says sniffing equals utmost evil in The Lord of the Rings. Yes, Kristen says hearing sniffing is so ominous. All sniffing is bad. Yes. Good. Good. Oh, and Rayla Lynn is recommending the German term Sehnsucht. What is Sehnsucht? I'm clicking the link here. Sehnsucht is a German noun translated as longing, pining, yearning, or craving, or a wider sense, a type of intensely missing. Oh, this is the, I forget the pronunciation, the Portuguese word saudade. I don't know how to pronounce that in Portuguese, but I do know how to pronounce it in Celtic. There's a notion in the Celtic languages, hereath, which means, literally means a homesickness for a place which you have never been. It is that kind of rootless longing, that tugging upon the soul that drives you onward or that holds you back, this longing for something that you do not know and cannot recognize. I find it so interesting that so many words, that so many languages have a word to describe this same oddly unquantifiable and yet quintessentially human feeling. Yes, Sehnsucht, the German version there of the Celtic word hereath, which endures today in the Welsh language and can also crop up from time to time in Scots too. Good, let me go. Let me catch up here. Samuel says, Gollum is a master sneak, like on Skyrim. He's the head of the Thieves Guild. He's done the Thieves Guild quests. That's what it is. It's the best quest chain in all of the Elder Scrolls games. So, of course, he's very good at it. I must admit, I always play a thief when I'm playing the Elder Scrolls games, too, just because sneaking is so much fun in those games. Arendel, says Shane. He can fly you away from the island. Very good. Very good choice. Yes. And Rayla Lynn asks the legitimate question here. Yeah, Danielle says, our little footpad is not affectionate, but it's not hateful either. His tome about Gollum is interesting. And Rayla Lynn says, what exactly could Gollum do with Aragorn, Legolas, and Sam nearby? He wouldn't stand a chance. No, mischief seems to be what we're most concerned about. Look at what Aragorn says here. You lie down now and I will keep watch for what is left of the night. I wish I could lay my hands on the wretch. We might make him useful. Immediately. It's not about vengeance with Aragorn, and we must remember that Aragorn went hunting for Gollum with Gandalf back before this adventure started. He was hunting for Gollum for the longest time, after Gollum had already given up the name Baggins and the word Shire to Sauron. So Aragorn was already hunting for Gollum. He's very familiar with this little guy. We might make him useful, but if I cannot, we shall have to try and lose him. He is very dangerous. So if we can find him, we might make him useful. He knows a thing or two about a thing or two. He might be able to give us information that might be playing his part in whatever great plan that Aragorn clearly perceives, that Gandalf perceived right back in Bag End when he was talking to Frodo about pity. Pity it was that stayed his hand, right? Gollum is not a trivial obstacle to be overcome. Gollum isn't like a nameless orc that we might slay. Gollum is corrupted, yes. Evil, yes. Dangerous, yes. But also it seems as though the wise are hearing an echo of Gollum in the song. You know, we have a sense here, as Gandalf said, you know, his intuition tells him that he has a sense that Gollum has a part to be played for good or for ill. I don't know if it's going to be our victory or our downfall is going to be caused by Gollum, but something somewhere, something inconsequential perhaps, is going to be caused by Gollum. And Aragorn clearly either feels that too or has taken Gandalf's teachings to heart. I wish I could lay my hands on the wretch. We might make him useful, but if I cannot, we shall have to try and lose him. He is very dangerous. Okay, why is he dangerous? Quite apart from murder by night on his own account, well, you know, apart from the fact that he might try and kill us, he may put any enemy that is about on our track. I think it's pretty clear from the emphasis that Aragorn uses there, the stress that he puts on the second part of that argument, that is his primary concern. Quite apart from murder by night on his own account. Yeah, he might try and kill us. Sure, cute, fine, good. You do you, Gollum. You try and kill us. Let's see how that works out for you, buddy. Quite apart from that, he may put any enemy that is about on our track. And right now, we must be elusive. Right now, we must dodge the orcs that we know are in this area, and we must look carefully at how this is foreshadowed consistently through the book, pretty much from the moment that we emerge from Moria. We know that orcs have passed up the river toward Moria. We learned that from Haldir. We know that orcs crossed the Nimrodale into Lothlorien. We saw that happen with our own eyes. Now, even as we're coming downriver, Aragorn's saying, yeah, I haven't been here in forever, and he's about to tell us, also, I've never traveled this river by boat. Huh, weird. it flows way faster than I thought that it would. I don't know anything about this, but I can tell you that there are orcs around. I can tell you that they've been firing across the River Anduin for long enough that no one now lives here. And I can tell you that I've heard rumors that they are crossing the Great River. They are everywhere. There is no question here, though the lands are empty, there is no question here that they have, in a sense, already crossed that frontier of war. We've already crossed into enemy territory, even though we are bounded on one side by what is theoretically Rohan, though even then, we don't know Rohan. Not just us as readers, but the characters here don't know Rohan. Boromir is suspicious of Rohan, and there are rumors abounding about what is happening in Rohan. So there's a lot still to cover, yeah. Yes, let me see here. Since Gollum is a hobbit cousin, says Angela, since Gollum is a hobbit cousin-like being, does he have a distortion of the hobbit luck? That's a really interesting idea, isn't it? Huh. It would confirm, it would explain a lot of what Gollum goes through, I think. I mean, it's a kind of perverse luck. Okay, are we willing to attribute to Gollum's hobbitish luck what we might also better attribute to Eucatastrophe, to the Divine Wind, to the Great Plan, whatever that Great Plan is? You know, I'll need to pay close attention to what Gollum does, because remember, the way that hobbit luck manifests itself is that it presents an opportunity, and it is only when that opportunity is taken that we see the hobbits kind of deliver on that luck, deliver on that potential, as it were. So it's possible that Gollum has a similar kind of thing. It's also possible that Gollum is a pawn in a much larger plan. Yeah. It's also possible that the corruption that has taken him and transformed him into what he is driving him onward just as readily. Let's keep going. Keep getting distracted by fascinating questions, you guys. We've got a lot of ground to cover. Here we are. Hey, Gollum might warn people. Now, note crucially that when Aragorn says, the real reason that we have to take care of Gollum is that he might warn enemies and they may be able to track us. Sam is asleep. Sam is asleep in the boat at that point. He took first watch, Frodo took second watch, Sam is asleep. And yet, with great efforts, they checked the boats and slowly brought them about. But at first they could make only small headway against the current, and all the time they were carried nearer and nearer to the eastern bank. Now dark and ominous, it loomed up in the night. All together, paddle, shouted Boromir. Paddle, or we shall be driven on the shore, on the shoals. Even as he spoke, Frodo felt the keel beneath him grate upon stone. At that moment, there was a twang of bowstrings. Several arrows whistled over them, and some fell among them. One smote Frodo between the shoulders, and he lurched forward with a cry, letting go his paddle, but the arrow fell back, foiled by his hidden coat of mail. Another passed through Aragorn's hood, and a third stood fast in the gunwale of the second boat, close by Merry's hand. Sam thought he could glimpse black figures running to and fro upon the long shingle banks that lay under the eastern shore. They seemed very near. "Ich," said Legolas, falling into his own tongue. "Orcs!" cried Gimli. "Gollum's doing, I'll be bound," said Sam to Frodo, "and a nice place to choose, too. The river seems set on taking us straight into their arms." "Gollum's doing, I'll be bound." Here are some orcs that infest this land. Here are the enemies. We've been, you know, anticipating this moment for the longest time. But now when we encounter them, Sam is already suspicious. "Gollum's doing, I'll be bound. And a nice place to choose to. The river seems set on taking us right into their arms." A nice place to choose to? The idea being not only that Gollum has arranged for the orcs to find them, but that Gollum has orchestrated, that he has masterminded this ambush here. Sam's, I'm not even sure that skepticism is the right word, Sam's distrust of Gollum is immediate and is profound here, yeah. Oh, that's very true. Jackie points out it wouldn't be the first time Sam pretended to be asleep, though. That is a very good point, Jackie, yes. Is Sam, oh no, have you just made me love Sam more? Jackie, have you achieved the impossible and made me love Sam Gamgee just a little bit more? Is it possible that after his first watch, he went and pretended to fall asleep so that Frodo could take the watch, but Sam stayed awake to keep his master company, and then if Frodo should fall asleep, he can kind of deftly and effortlessly take over? Damn, that's almost certainly what happened, isn't it? Okay, yes, there it is. That's not even that's not even headcanon. That's just canon. That's text right there. It does sound very Sam-like, Nikki. You're absolutely right. And Alan says, that's so Sam. That's, yes. Yes, it really is. Okay, good. I can't believe I didn't think of that. You're completely correct. Anyway, orcs attack. Terrible things are happening. The river is carrying the fellowship toward the orcs, and then things get worse still. Legolas laid down his paddle and took up the bow that he had brought from Lorien. Then he sprang ashore and climbed a few paces up the bank. Stringing the bow and fitting an arrow, he turned, peering back over the river into the darkness. Across the water there were shrill cries, but nothing could be seen. Frodo looked up at the elf standing tall above him, and he gazed into the night, seeking a mark to shoot at. His head was dark, crowned with sharp white stars that glittered in the black pools of the sky behind. But now, rising and sailing up from the south, the great clouds advanced, sending out dark outriders into the starry fields. A sudden dread fell on the company. "Elbereth Gilthoniel," sighed Legolas as he looked up. Even as he did so, a dark shape like a cloud, and yet not a cloud, for it moved far more swiftly, came out of the blackness in the south and sped toward the company, blotting out all light as it approached. Soon it appeared as a great winged creature, blacker than the pits in the night. Fierce voices rose up to greet it from across the water. Frodo felt a sudden chill running through him and clutching at his heart. There was a deadly cold, like the memory of an old wound in his shoulder. He crouched down, as if to hide. Suddenly the great bow of Lorien sang. Shrill went the arrow from the elven string. Frodo looked up. Almost above him the winged shape swerved. There was a harsh, croaking scream as it fell out of the air, vanishing down into the gloom of the eastern shore. The sky was clean again. There was a tumult of many voices far away, cursing and wailing in the darkness. And then silence. Neither shaft nor cry came again from the east that night. Sometimes Tolkien will turn to a metaphor which is so inappropriate, so inelegant in its construction, that it gains a new kind of elegance, that it gains a new kind of beauty. We talked about this all the way back at Tom Bombadil's house when Frodo and the others behold for the first time Goldberry, and we get this brilliant metaphor, right? It was as if they, all unknowing, had come to the house seeking to beg a cup of sugar and had opened it, and there was a fair elf maid clad in living flowers. You know, that experience that we've all had. And here we get another one of Tolkien's. Like, this is too crisp to be unintentional, right? This is not a bad metaphor. This is a perfect metaphor in its literality. Frodo felt a sudden chill running through him and clutching at his heart. There was a deadly cold, like the memory of an old wound in his shoulder. Oh, that would be the deadly cold caused by his old wound, right? This, I think there is enough evidence in the text here that I'm not actually spoiling anything. And certainly I remember this being my intimation the first time that I read the book. This is the Nazgul. This is the Black Rider, newly born aloft on this foul-winged creature. We're going to find that out for sure later in the book, but this is the return of the Black Riders. They have been dormant because after their disastrous encounter with Elvendom at the Ford of Ruinen, they fled south once again. They have gathered their strength, and now they are returning. And we must remember that it has been something like 3 months, 4 months since the Ford of 4 months almost since the Ford of Bruinen. So it's been some time, and now they're coming back. And we see too, we see the influence of the elves here. It is no coincidence that Legolas sighs Elbereth Gilthoniel before he stiffens his courage and takes the shot. We get that emphasis. Suddenly the great bow of Lorien sang, not just his great bow, but his great bow of Lorien. Shrill went the arrow from the elven string. Not shrill went the arrow from the string, but shrill went the arrow from the elven string, from the elven hair string. This is an arrow imbued with the magic of elves in general, from the hand of an elf, but of Lothlorien in particular. I suppose we don't know which elf gave hair for Legolas's bow. Let's say it was Celeborn. Let's assume that could have been Haldir. You know, could have been any one of the elves that lives in Lothlorien. We actually have no idea how many elves live in Lothlorien or indeed in Middle-earth. So I choose to believe that it's one that was named. Let's say that it was either Celeborn or Haldir. It would have been much more significant if it had been Galadriel, of course. Shane, with musical refrain, observes, "You can't take the sky from me." Yes, the sky now is clean again. Let's just imagine Legolas in this one scene in a brown coat. I think that might work out actually really rather beautifully. Nikki observes, "The Nazgul reappears with the utterance of Elbereth Gilthoniel." Yes, once again, we get a connection between those two. That's excellent. Good, good. Like Dementors, as Gildarts Winters points out. Yes, yes. As Legolas sighs, yeah, Jared's drawing the same connection. Legolas sighs the same names that Frodo cried out before being stabbed on Weathertop. Yeah, it's this same connection. It's the same trickle there. Yes. When like, as R. Faramir says, is not just like. And Alan observes, yeah, the sky was clean again. I love that. Like the beast was tainting the sky itself. Yeah, Jackie's laughing at the thought of Celeborn donating hair for bowstrings, but really, I mean, what else is Celeborn doing? The Lord of the Galathrim is counted greatest among the wise and has dwelt here for years and years and years, but hey, have I mentioned how Galadriel's really in charge and is just, you know, the whole thing, like the whole thing, Celeborn, really not that significant, it turns out, in Lothlorien? Yeah, he may as well just be sitting around, you know, giving up hairs for the bowstrings. Good. Good. Elven version of Firefly, says Gildarts Winters. We could, at the very least, translate the opening song, translate the brilliant opening song from Firefly into Sindarin. Someone can get on that. That would be fantastic. Yeah. Okay. I have no idea what the guy does, says Jackie. Hey, Jackie, you, me, everyone. We just don't know. We know that he is counted among the wise. We know that that's true. We know that that's, you know, Galadriel goes so far out of her way to give an accounting of Celeborn when we get to Lothlorien that it almost starts to sound sarcastic, and then, of course, follows it up with that perfect smackdown. Yeah, we'll talk about the marriage dynamics between Galadriel and Celeborn another time. Yes, so something winged this way comes. Legolas attacks and drives it off with his remarkable elven bow shot, and then we get silence for the rest of the night. We then move on. Gosh, I'm running so late. I'm going to gloss over this one because we've already talked about it. I'm just going to pass this slide here. This is Sam realizing that time passes differently in Lothlorien. And then we get, Frodo says, and perhaps that was the way of it, said Frodo, in that land maybe we were in a time that is somewhere long, that is elsewhere long gone by. It was not, I think, until Silverload bore us back to Anduin that we returned to the time that flows through mortal lands to the great sea. And I don't remember any moon, either new or old, in Kairos Galathon, only stars by night and sun by day. Legolas stirred in his boat. Nay, time does not tarry ever, he said, but change and growth is not in all things and places alike. For the elves the world moves, and it moves both very swift and very slow. Swift because they themselves change little, and all else fleets by, it is a grief to them. Slow, because they need not count the running years, not for themselves. The passing seasons are but ripples ever repeated in the long, long stream, yet beneath the sun all things must wear to an end at last. And then we get this cap from Frodo. But the wearing is slow in Lorien, said Frodo. The power of the lady is on it. Rich are the hours, though short they seem, in Kairos Galathon, where Galadriel wields the elven ring. Frodo perhaps displaying a certain ignorance of the implication of Galadriel's, you know, rejection of the One Ring and her utterance about her eventual fate. The power of the lady is on it. Rich are the hours, though short they seem, in Kairos Galathon, where Galadriel wields the Elven Ring. I mean, yeah, not for long, ironically. You know, time is going to pass in Lothlorien now. I do love Frodo using the return to the river Anduin, which you'll remember that Galadriel used it herself in the song. You know, when she sings her kind of farewell to the Fellowship, she uses this same idea that the river is flowing as a passage of time, which, by the way, as a kind of, as a metaphor for the passage of time in elven culture, literally goes all the way back to the Tralalalolly song in The Hobbit. Remember, you know, where are you going? The river is flowing. We're getting that sense that, well, why are you telling us that? Oh, because it's a symbol of the passage of time, right? Time is passing. The river is flowing. That works really rather beautifully here. But time in Lothlorien, as in fairy, is both more slow and more swift than we might expect. Rich are the hours, though short they seem. Yeah, yeah, rich, but short. That's a pretty good encapsulation, actually, of elven life and elven culture. From there, though, we get to the end of this chapter. Behold, my fellow travelers here in Middle-earth, behold the Argonauth. Frodo, peering forward, saw in the distance two great rocks approaching. Like great pinnacles or pillars of stone, they seemed. Tall and sheer and ominous, they stood upon either side of the stream. A narrow gap appeared between them, and the river swept the boats towards it. Behold the Argonauth, the pillars of the kings, cried Aragorn. We shall pass them soon. Keep the boats in line and as far apart as you can. Hold the middle of the stream. As Frodo was borne toward them, the great pillars rose like towers to meet him. Giants, they seemed to him, vast gray figures, silent but threatening. Then he saw that they were indeed shaped and fashioned. The craft and power of old had wrought upon them, and still they preserved through the suns and rains of forgotten years the mighty likenesses in which they had been hewn. Upon great pedestals founded in the deep waters stood two great kings of stone. Still with blurred eyes and crannied brows, they frowned upon the north. The left hand of each was raised palm upwards in gesture of warning. In each right hand there was an axe. Upon each head there was a crumbling helm and crown. Great power and majesty they still wore, the silent wardens of a long-vanished kingdom. Awe and fear fell upon Frodo, and he cowered down, shutting his eyes and not daring to look up as the boat drew near. Even Boromir bowed his head as the boats whirled by, frail and fleeting as little leaves under the enduring shadow of the sentinels of Numenor. So they passed into the dark chasm of the gates. Sheer rose the dreadful cliffs to unguessed heights on either side. Far off was the dim sky. The black waters roared and echoed, and a wind screamed over them. Frodo crouching over his knees, heard Sam in front muttering and groaning, "What a place! What a horrible place! Just let me out of this boat! I'll never wet my toes in a puddle again, let alone a river!" "Fear not," said a strange voice behind him. Frodo turned and saw Strider, and yet not Strider, for the weather-worn ranger was no longer there. In the stern sat Aragorn, son of Arathorn, proud and erect, guiding the boat with skillful strokes. His hood was cast back, and his dark hair was blowing in the wind. A light was in his eyes, a king returning from exile to his own land. "Fear not," he said. "Long have I desired to look upon the likenesses of Isildur and Anarion, my sires of old. Under their shadow, Elisar, the Elfstone, son of Arathorn of the house of Elendil, Isildur's son, heir of Elendil, has naught to dread." It's pretty great, you guys. It's pretty great. Yes. As Raylan says, Aragorn, badass mode, activate. Yeah, he's just leveled up, but good here as they approach the Argonauth. Jenna says Aragorn has too many names. I do love it when we get all of his names. I love it when we get all of anyone's names. This is perhaps the element that George R.R. Martin has inherited most directly, most powerfully, and most effectively from the works of J.R.R. Tolkien, the repetition of names. Of course, we get that best with Daenerys Targaryen. I mean, her list of names is pretty good. It's pretty epic, but for me, doesn't quite touch. Elisar, the Elfstone, son of Arathorn of the House of Elendil, Isildur, son, heir of Elendil, has naught to dread. Strider's gone. Aragorn, son of Arathorn, is among us again. This is, I think, the third time that we've had this happen. Fourth, actually, if you count the gift in Lothlorien. You know, we've seen this happen with Aragorn before. He is Strider most of the time. And we get that as Frodo turns, right? Frodo turned and saw Strider. It's crucial there that Frodo turns because we are now in Frodo's POV, right? We're oftentimes close to Frodo, but we're in a more distant third-person POV. But right here, we're in Frodo's experience. How do we know that we're in Frodo's experience? Because Frodo turns and sees Strider and yet not Strider. The hobbits are the only ones who refer to him as Strider at this point, and even then, intermittently. The narration has pretty much given up. Look at the beginning of this passage. "Behold the Argonauth, the pillars of the kings," cried Aragorn. He's Aragorn to us now. He's Strider to Frodo. We move into Frodo's POV so that we can get this more powerful reveal, which echoes the powerful reveal that we've had before, of course. The Argonauth, Royal Stones in Sindarin. Not the most imaginative name, perhaps, but Royal Stones they are. Depict, as Aragorn tells us here, Isildur and Anarion, the sons of Elendil the Tall, who basically, the story is complicated and we don't have time to gloss the whole thing, but suffice it to say that Elendil and his sons Isildur and Anarion founded Arnor in the north and Gondor in the south. That is the breakup there. We should say, too, that the Argonauth, Ar means of royalty, it means monarchistic, it's royal there. The Gon in the middle of Argonauth is the same stone root as Gondor, so it's connected there, and then the Oth is a plural derivation. But usually I think it's used to mean a pair. I'll need to brush up on my Sindarin for this to be sure, but I'm pretty sure that it means a pair of things or paired sets of things. So yeah, Argonauth, the pair of royal stones, I suppose, is how you can best track this. Good, let me see as I catch up here. Yeah, Jared says, the movie did not capture the fear of the party when they see the statues. No, that is what was missing from this for me. I love the depiction of the Argonauth here in the Peter Jackson adaptation. I absolutely love it. I think it's visually just astonishing and completely convincing, which I like a lot. He does make another little change there. He gives Isildur the sword rather than the axe. Apparently, Numenorean kings would wield axes because, of course, we're dealing with, you know, Anglo-Saxon traditions here in part in J.R.R. Tolkien's inspiration. But Jackson made the decision to, no, let's give Isildur a sword. That probably makes a little more sense, which I actually really like as an adaptive choice there. But yeah. Let me see here. Oh, Daenerys wins because Aragorn doesn't have dragons in his title. That's actually fair. I think that might be fair. Yes. Aragorn, crazy uncle of dragons? Maybe. Let me see here. I'm trying to scroll through and I'm just not getting them. Oh no, we're getting audio distortion. Is that, oh, that's terrible. Are we getting some? Okay. If you're getting any, yeah, if we're getting any audio distortion here, just, you know, control R, F5, do what you have to do to refresh it. Well, Fina's also asking, when will we have a Winter is Coming podcast? When it's done, the minute it's done, I'm going to podcast about Game of Thrones. I am a very big fan of a lot of what George R.R. Martin has done in those books. I'm a very big fan of many of the adaptive choices that have been made by the show. I am now 3 seasons behind the show. I basically stopped watching the show because the HBO release schedule just wasn't working for me at all. So I'm going to marathon it when it is done. I think that the critical discourse surrounding Game of Thrones actually does a huge disservice to George R.R. Martin and does a lesser disservice to the show itself. There is so much more intentionality in Martin's work, in the prose on the page. And I think, too, to a lesser extent, so much more intentionality in the show than is generally given due credit. I think that these are much more careful and much less self-indulgent books than the common discourse would have it, you know, internet discourse in particular would have it. So yes, definitely. There is a pretty good chance, you guys, that when we're done with There and Back Again, we might, what would we call it? To the Wall. We might, I don't know, but we'll call it something, an exploration of George R.R. Martin's Westeros and Essos and other places in between, I guess. That's what we'll call it. We'll come up with a catchier title than that, but yeah, we will definitely be doing it. Yes, Balls to the Wall suggests Skilled Arts Winters. That's very good, actually. That's very, very good. Yes, okay. Yeah, Andrew is referencing here the survival of Isildur and Anarion, surviving the sinking of Atlantis. I mean, Numenor, yes. I've mentioned that, right? That in Sindarin, the cataclysmic sinking of Numenor is rendered as the word Atalantea, which was apparently a complete coincidence. That was apparently just a consequence of Sindarin linguistic structures that Tolkien had already put in place, despite the fact that the whole reason that he told the legend of Numenor is that he himself, well, not the whole reason, but a significant contributory factor toward the story of Numenor is that Tolkien himself had dreams of, you know, great waves crashing across the landscape for all of his life, dreams which apparently his son had too. I mean, It's myth. There's myth for you, right? Myth emerges wherever there is a gap there. Wherever story can happen, it will happen. Okay, let me see here. We're still talking about George R.R. Martin. That's fine. That's good. Okay, good. We'll catch up with all of that. That's fine. Good. So that's the Argonauth. We should talk a little, I guess, about the layout here, because we get a lot of proper nouns thrown at us as we're moving into the next chapter, and I want to kind of lay this out to you. So there is here a lake that we are entering into. This is the Lake of Nen Hithoel, which is mist-cool water in Sindarin. A really evocative and beautiful Sindarin name. Nen Hithoel, mist-cool water here. This is the lake. It is 20 miles long. It is a very significant body of water. It flows from the Anduin. The Anduin flows through the Argonauth into Nen Hithoel itself. Then we have our the falls of Roros on the far end, which just is Sindarin for roaring spray. Another kind of very literal name there. So we have the Argonauth at one end and the falls of Roroth at the other end, the northern and the southern tips of the lake here. Then on the western shore, we have Amon Hen, the seat of seeing. The western shore, of course, is on our right as we are passing down from the north into the lake here. And on the eastern shore, on our left, we have Amon Law, the seat of hearing. Then in the middle of the lake, so between these two, we have these two great seats, these two great promontories on the eastern and western shores of the lake. But then in the middle of the lake, between these two things, kind of carving the river in twain, the river flows around it, which is, you know, gosh, all kinds of representative too, when we're thinking about Isildur and Anarion, and we're thinking of the founding of Arnor in the north and Gondor in the south and the splitting of the kingdom. And then, of course, past Tol Brandir, which is the island that cleaves the river in twain, past Tol Brandir, upon which no foot has ever tread, we're told, you know, no one has ever set foot upon that island. So we get Tol Brandir between, we've got seeing on one side and hearing on the other, then Tol Brandir in the middle, cleaving the river in two. And then, of course, on the other side of Tol Brandir, the river reforms. The river is restored. The river is reunified, which seemed to me to always be a very kind of eloquent, you know, geographical metaphor there. I like that quite a lot. The other word, or the other, you know, name that we're going to get here is the Parthgallon. We're going to get the green sword. We're going to get the lawn, effectively, that runs down to the shore of the lake on the western edge. Yes, so that's going to be Parthgallon. So basically, we've got the lake, we've got the two great hills, we've got the island in the middle, and we've got the green sword that comes down to the side of the lake too. I didn't mention, even when we were talking about this earlier, it's the word sword now has just reminded me of it. But when we were talking about Legolas on the edge of the boat firing his arrows across the Anduin, did you catch that description of him? Having the stars above him, crowning him above his head as though reflected in waters, that for some reason here we're directly echoing the crown of Durin in the Miramir and attaching it to Legolas. I am so struck by that image, and I have no idea what it means. I have no idea why we are doing that then. But the idea of Legolas being haloed with a crown of stars as he is fighting orcs on the banks of the Anduin here, and specifically, you know, the specific reference to as though reflected in water, deliberately calling forth the idea of Durin's crown in the Miramir, I love that. That is so beautiful, so powerful, and I have no idea what it means. I have no idea why we're drawing that connection at that point. If you guys have any ideas, let me know. Perhaps next week, in fact, because we're going to have some time for a little Q&A next week. Okay, that takes us to the end of Chapter 9. We only have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 slides left to go. Okay, we're not going to get through all of these. Let's get to... Gosh, okay, I did this on purpose. Here's the thing. Next week, we're going to have a special session. Let me cancel this slide. Next week, we're going to have a special session because next week, I want to kind of take a skip week before we push on into the Two Towers. I want to take a breath. We're not actually going to take a skip week. There is going to be a live session, but I want to kind of look back at the entirety of the Fellowship of the Ring. We've been very close to the text as we've been looking at this story. And what I want to do is take a half step back and look at the story as a whole. What is the story of the Fellowship of the Ring? Where did we begin? Where did we end? What was the arc that was described for each of our primary characters in this course? What do we make of the Shire and Tom Bombadil and Weathertop and Rivendell and Moria and Lothlorien in the span of the entire first volume of The Lord of the Rings? What do we make of that? So I want to do that next week. I also wanted to take some Q&A and just kind of have some general discussion about the Fellowship of the Ring. I think we're definitely, since it is now 20 after 10, and theoretically I have 10 minutes left, I think we're definitely going to have to wait and study Boromir's betrayal next time because we've just taken so long. But let's keep pushing on. Anyway, nonetheless, into chapter 10 here, into the final chapter of the Fellowship of the Ring. They drew up their boats on the green banks, and beside them they made their camp. They set a watch, but had no sight nor sound of their enemies. If Gollum had contrived to follow them, he remained unseen and unheard. Nonetheless, as the night wore on, Aragorn grew uneasy, tossing often in his sleep and waking. In the small hours, he got up and came to Frodo, whose turn it was to watch. "Why are you waking?" asked Frodo. "It's not your watch." "I do not know," answered Aragorn. "But a shadow and a threat has been growing in my sleep. It would be well to draw your sword." "Why?" said Frodo. "Are enemies at hand?" "Let us see what sting may show," answered Aragorn. Frodo then drew the elf blade from its sheath. To his dismay, the edges gleamed dimly in the night. "Orcs," he said. "Not very near, and yet too near, it seems." "I feared as much," said Aragorn. "But maybe they are not on this side of the river. The light of sting is faint, and it may point to no more than spies of Mordor roaming on the slopes of Amon Law. I have never heard before of orcs upon Amon Han, and who knows what may happen in these evil days, now that Minas Tirith no longer holds secure the passages of Anduin. We must go warily tomorrow." Even here, even among the great relics, not just of, you know, Gondor, not just of Arnor, not just of a theoretically restored united kingdom of North and South, but here, amid the relics of Numenor, this is the most direct line that we've had back to Numenor in the book so far, really. Even here, the orcs are exerting a fell influence. Even here, the war is already present. Time has passed. It passed in Rivendell. It passed beneath Moria. It passed in Lothlorien. And now the passage to Mordor may be all but impossible. Though, of course, I guess the passage to Mordor was already all but impossible. Yes. Do we have some suggestions here? This is very, again, says Jackie, Just too easy to wake the ranger. I love how easy it is for Aragorn to wake. I love that his thoughts are troubled. He has a spider sense about this, right? He has a sixth sense that seems to be tied to his Numenorean blood, tied to his kingship, certainly, tied to his connection to the Fellowship, tied to his experience as a ranger, as one of the Dunedain. You know, he has traveled far. He has fought on the fringes of civilization, and he knows the shadow. He knows the darkness. It's extraordinarily powerful. And every time I start talking about Aragorn being a ranger, I'm reminded of the wonderful TV show Babylon 5, where I just want to talk about the rangers there, which are basically lifted wholesale from The Lord of the Rings. Much of Babylon 5 is lifted wholesale from The Lord of the Rings. In fact, it's pretty good. Let me see here. I wanted to pull... Gosh, the chat is scrolling fast. Yeah, okay, we're going deep into the Silmarillion here with some talk of future marriage. It's fine, we'll get there. Also, Danielle says, we see the Miramir after leaving a dwarf place, but not Gimli specifically, but the most dwarf place. Then have it echoed with Legolas leaving an elf place, not Legolas's, but the most elf place. There's something. Danielle, that's very good. Danielle, I like that a great, great deal, because... Well, I mean, I like the parallel. I like that very much. First off, there is something profoundly eloquent about looking down, dwarves looking down into the Miramir and beholding Durin's crown, and Legolas not exactly looking up, but Frodo looking up past Legolas and seeing Durin's crown in the sky, not the reflection, but, you know, metaphorically connected to the reflection. I like that very much. That would suggest that Durin's crown is not... a purely dwarven phenomenon? Huh. Okay, I'm going to give that some thought. We'll talk about that at some distant point in the future, I guess. It'll be fine, you guys. It'll be fine. I mean, the most literal kind of connection, I suppose, is that Tolkien is kind of echoing the symbolism of Durin's crown here, right? That crowned by stars is not actually a specifically Durin thing, that crowned by stars is representative. You know, we can think of the White Tree of Gondor, we can think of, you know, the use of stars on the gates of Moria. There, you know, the connection between royalty and stars anyway is very powerful and very profound in The Lord of the Rings. So it may be that we're just echoing the same kind of symbolism here, the same iconography here, because we must be reminded that Legolas is a prince. He is the son of Thranduil. He is apparently the heir of Thranduil. He is going to inherit, if elves, you know, directly inherit in that way, elven kingship is much more loose than that. We don't exactly know how Thranduil's kingdom works on the inside in quite that regard. But yes, if it is fair to say that there is a royal line in Mirkwood, then Legolas is of that royal line. So it's not inappropriate that he have that above his head. Yeah, it's a little difficult to pin down, but I could just spend forever on this. Let me see. We got a... I'm being referred to a comment here that I think I'm missing. Oh, no, the chat is just moving so fast, you guys. I'm being told that R. Faramir... Jackie's telling me that R. Faramir has put his finger on it with the... the stars here. Yes, Elrohir, Eladon, and Aragorn wear a star on their foreheads, right? Yes, that's the kind of star iconography connection that I wanted to call back to. Yes, absolutely. There are innumerable connections, gosh. Okay. Something else that we can pull in the future. Good. Yeah, we definitely can't talk about Varda right now. We definitely can't get into that right now. Okay, so there are orcs about, but we might be safe. But there are more important questions to address, because we have made it. We have made it through the Argonauth. We have made it to the falls. Now we have to make our decision. What next? When they had eaten, Aragorn called the company together. The day has come at last, he said. The day of choice, which we have long delayed. What shall now become of our company that has traveled so far in fellowship? Shall we turn west with Boromir and go to the wars of Gondor? Or turn east to the fear and shadow? Or shall we break our fellowship and go this way and that, as each may choose? Whatever we do must be done soon. We cannot long halt here. The enemy is on the eastern shore, we know, but I fear that the orcs may already be on this side of the water. There was a long silence in which no one spoke or moved. Well, Frodo, said Aragorn at last, I fear that the burden is laid upon you. You are the bearer appointed by the council. Your own way you alone can choose. In this matter I cannot advise you. I am not Gandalf. And though I have tried to bear his part, I do not know what design or hope he had for this hour, if indeed he had any. More likely it seems that if he were here now, the choice would still wait on you. Such is your fate. Frodo did not answer at once. Then he spoke slowly. I know that haste is needed, yet I cannot choose. The burden is heavy. Give me an hour longer and I will speak. Let me be alone. Aragorn looked at him with kindly pity. Very well, Frodo, son of Drogo, he said. You shall have an hour, and you shall be alone. We will stay here for a while, but do not stray far or out of call. Frodo sat for a moment with his head bowed. Sam, who had been watching his master with great concern, shook his head and muttered, Plain as a pikestaff it is, it's no good Sam Gamgee putting in his spoke just now. Presently Frodo got up and walked away, and Sam saw that while the others restrained themselves and did not stare at him, the eyes of Boromir followed Frodo intently, until he passed out of sight in the trees at the foot of Aman Han. Aragorn actually doing a very good job of standing in for Gandalf at this point. Though not a perfect job. You are the bearer, capital B, appointed by the council. Well, the council didn't strictly appoint Frodo as the bearer of the ring. I guess Bilbo kind of did that, and then Gandalf kind of did it again. But the person who appointed Frodo as the bearer of the ring was Frodo. Remember all the way back in Bag End when Frodo stepped up and took his quest. And when we're thinking next week in our next session about the shape of the Fellowship of the Ring, I'm going to be thinking about these two moments. I'm going to be thinking about Frodo's decisions, because Frodo's decisions bookmark this entire event, this entire volume, bookmark this entire book is what I was going to say, but that is inelegant. And actually we're talking about two books. So I will say instead, Frodo's decisions bookmark this entire volume. Back in Bag End, he makes the choice. Gandalf presents him with all of the necessary information, and then Frodo makes the choice, as we discussed at the time. And now here again, he is called upon to make the choice. But circumstances now are a little different. And it maybe feels as though Aragorn isn't giving him a completely balanced perspective here. What shall now become of our company that has traveled so far in fellowship? Shall we turn west with Boromir and go to the wars of Gondor? Or turn east to the Fear, capital F, and the Shadow, capital S? Or shall we break our fellowship and go this way and that as each may choose? Whatever we do must be done soon. We cannot long halt here. This is the end of the fellowship. This is the end of this book. It all comes down to Frodo's decision. It doesn't come down to the betrayal of Boromir. It doesn't come down to what eventually happens to Boromir. And this is a beat, I think, that can be easily missed. This is a beat that can easily be misremembered or misconstrued, particularly for those of us who are terribly familiar with the Peter Jackson adaptations. I completely understand why Peter Jackson wanted to put the death of Boromir right at the end of the Fellowship of the Ring. Makes a ton of sense. Really works. Strong choice. But that's not what Tolkien did. And don't think for a second that Tolkien didn't think of it. He made a purposeful choice. He is bookmarking the fellowship here. He is bracketing the fellowship here with Frodo's decision. In this matter, I cannot advise you. I am not Gandalf, and though I have tried to bear his part, I do not know what design or hope he had in this hour, if indeed he had any. Most likely, it seems that if he were here now, the choice would still wait on you. Such is your fate. Sorry, dude. Sorry, little guy. This is pretty terrible for you, but you're the ring bearer, so, take an hour, walk around, shake it off, maybe, have a Capri Sun, have an orange, just kind of, get your head right, and then we can go on and we can figure out what we're going to do next. The fate of the world is hanging in the balance, and there are a lot of orcs nearby, so do that thing. And then Sam, of course, watching Boromir, watching Frodo is a beautiful detail. What do we make of Sam here? Plain as a pikestaff it is, but it's no good Sam Gamgee putting in his spoke just now. Well, he's clearly saying, all right, it's self-evident to me what we should do, but hey, it's obvious that I shouldn't say anything right now. What is obvious to Sam? What do you make of this comment? What is plain as a pikestaff? Which is, by the way, an old English phrase there, yeah. Let me see here. A really perplexed four-year popped into my head at wedding ring bearer, says Gildarts. Yes, good. I remember the fashion when the Lord of the Rings movies were coming out for, wedding bands being replications of the One Ring. And never really understood that as an aesthetic choice. I mean, I suppose, okay, strictly as an aesthetic choice, I kind of see it. It's a plain gold band. That's great. As a symbol, though, maybe not the symbol that I would go for. turns out. Maybe not, even Tolkien fan as I am, maybe not the symbol that I would go for. Maybe not wearing an artifact of unutterable evil on your ring finger there. Raylalyn says, Aragorn sings, history has its eyes on you. Okay, so now we also need a Lord of the Rings Hamilton mashup. Is that what we're doing? I don't hate it. I don't hate it, actually. Is there a way that we can do Aragorn, son of Arathorn, to the rhythm of Alexander Hamilton? It sounds like that's close enough that we could probably make that work, right? I think we could probably do it. Yeah, yeah. I'm just thinking now of the opening, you know, the overture to Hamilton, where he's, you know, on the prow of the ship as it's coming into New York, and just thinking of scenes later in The Lord of the Rings where that's going to be pretty apparent, actually. That's going to be pretty useful. Okay, good. Let's see here. Yes, okay, I think we're good. Frodo's choice. Sam was going with him no matter what he chose, says Jared. Okay, so he knows that Frodo has to leave. He knows that Sam's going to go with him. That's so says Jenna here. Yeah, I think that's my reading too, because we must remember that we're presented with three choices, right? That shall we turn west with Boromir and go to the Wars of Gondor, turn east to the Fear and the Shadow? Those are our two options. Well, okay, the third option is we break the fellowship and we go wherever we are driven to go. Maybe that's what Sam is saying. Plain as a pikestaff, I'm going with Frodo. Like, it doesn't matter to me what Frodo chooses. I'm going with him. But then it's no good Sam Gamgee putting in his spoke right now. I'm just not sure what it is that he would advocate for. Guys, we are, let me see, already over time, and I have a number of slides left to get to. So I think what we're going to do is cover Boromir's betrayal next time. I think that's what we'll do. Let me take a look at the questions here. A great question from Johnny's Virtual Journeys here in the question box. Why are the dwarves good guys if Tolkien was so against industry? And Tolkien Lover says they're against the orcs, who were also industrious. That is a great pull, Tolkien Lover. I think you're absolutely right on the money. Remember, back in the pages of The Hobbit, we have that great opposition between the dwarves and the goblins, as they are in The Hobbits. Is it in this chapter that the hobbits refer to the orcs as goblins, which is super adorable, actually, like weirdly adorable at this point, now that we're used to thinking of them as Irch. This is all I can think of now is Legolas's little elven word that he uses to describe them. Irch, it feels so Scottish is what it is, which I think is why I'm ing that last phrase there. Anyway, so we have the dwarves and the goblins in The Hobbit, and they are presented in a kind of opposition, right? What is the difference between the dwarves and the goblins? Well, the dwarves do not enslave. The dwarves do not primarily make weapons. They do fashion swords and axes and armor. They certainly make weapons and the tools, the accoutrements of war. They certainly do that, but they don't build primarily weapons. And they certainly don't do, as the goblins do, build indiscriminate weapons. The goblins are crafting explosives and weapons of mass destruction, to borrow a now weirdly outdated phrase. The goblins will build things to kill, and the dwarves don't. But they're not completely dissimilar. Certainly the greed and the avarice of dwarves is not comparable to the greed and the avarice and the mischief and the evil of goblins in The Hobbit, or orcs. And, you know, just to kind of emphasize this point, goblins and orcs, the same thing. I'm kind of changing the term that I use depending on whether or not I'm talking about The Hobbit or talking about The Lord of the Rings, because the depiction does change a little bit as we move there. Dwarves and orcs are not completely dissimilar in that regard, but they're also not the same. To say that they are not dissimilar is not to suggest for a moment that they are one and the same. So why are the dwarves good guys? Well, I would kind of hesitate to say that they're good guys. First off, I don't think that any of the mortal races are outright good guys. Who are the good guys? Maybe the wizards? Well, okay, but Saruman turns. You know, the Astari come to Middle-earth expressly to fight Sauron, but Saruman turns. So not even all the wizards are good. The men certainly aren't good. Men are corrupt and fall all the damn time. Even the hobbits, who we kind of hold up as paragons of virtue, are not above some minor, you know, minor venality. They're not above some minor contraventions of their own social contract. And then we get greater, you know, contraventions of that social contract. We get, you know, Ted Sandyman, and we're going to be dealing with him right at the end of the book. That kind of thing. Even the elves, you know. Galadriel is in Lothlorien because she was part of the Noldor Rebellion. She was exiled. The reason that she can't go back is because she wanted power. She wanted to rule. Now, it was a benevolent kind of rule, but it was rule nonetheless. That is why she went to Middle-earth in the first place. That is why she is exiled. That is why when she sings the, and now if I should sing of ships, which ship would come for me, you know? That's why she's worried now that she doesn't get to go home, because she's not actually perfect. So I would question whether or not the dwarves are supposed to be, you know, simple, capital G, good guys. Also, the dwarves are created. The dwarves are not, strictly speaking, children of Ilúvatar. They are not the same as the elves or the men or the hobbits. They are different because they were created by Ali. They were imbued with life by Ilúvatar, but they were not a part of the original conception, I suppose. Although ultimately, of course, Aule's creation of them was probably a part of the original conception, but they're not quite the same. So that, I think, is the distinction. What I would kind of distill away, dwarves, as is true for so many people in the fictional frame of The Lord of the Rings, in the fictional frame of Middle-earth, dwarves go bad when they are greedy and when they are prideful. That's it. It seems as though the default state of dwarves is not greedy or prideful. Remember the great discussions that we had about Erebor back in The Hobbit, and the great discussions that we've had about Moria here in The Lord of the Rings, that for the longest period of time, there was you know, civility and companionship between, in the case of Erebor, you know, the Lonely Mountain and Dale and the Elven King's realm in Mirkwood. And then with Moria, we've got Holland on the western edge, and we've got Lothlorien on the eastern edge. And isn't everything great? Isn't everything just wonderful? And then they fall. But if falling is an indication of evil, then everyone is evil, because everyone has fallen. Everything has fallen. This is a diminished world. We are fighting, as Galadriel says, the long defeat. Though, and I was thinking about this in the wake of last week's session, and maybe this is the thought that we'll wrap up on here tonight. I was thinking that perhaps I put the emphasis in the wrong place when I was talking about Galadriel talking about fighting the long defeat. Because, as I said, the long defeat is indicative of this long decline. Everything declines in Middle-earth. Everything falls. The greatest days are behind us. Elrond remembers the hosts of the Last Alliance, which were pretty great, a lot better than we could do now, but nothing compared to, you know, the older armies of elves and men. The might of the world has diminished and dwindled, and now we're sending nine people on the greatest quest that's ever been undertaken. Now it doesn't matter if you win or lose, Frodo. The elves are going to depart. The world is going to fail. Men are less than they were. Hobbits, presumably even hobbits, are going to be ultimately less than they were. The world is in decline. That is the long defeat, coupled with the idea that, well, hey, we beat Melkor and we drove evil from the world and everything was perfect thereafter. Sauron. Okay, we beat Sauron and drove evil from the world and everything was perfect thereafter. Okay, we found the One Ring again, and this time the war is actually going really badly, but we'll probably beat him this time. And when we do, we will drive evil from the... Are you following me here? This is fighting the long defeat. Or, more strictly, that is the long defeat. But the choice of verb is important. They are still fighting. They aren't yielding to the long defeat. They aren't enduring the long defeat. They are still fighting. And that speaks, this was on my mind last week after we finished talking during the live session. The idea that we can take up arms against overwhelming odds in a hopeless cause, that we can strive against overwhelming odds, and that the striving, that the fighting itself contains hope and virtue and goodness, that it is representative of something greater. No, that it is representative of something greater, but is also in and of itself something greater, that it is also virtue itself. That is a crucial idea. What separates the dwarves from the goblins? What separates the dwarves from the orcs? Why are the dwarves good guys? Because the dwarves are still fighting the long defeat. The dwarves resist corruption. They fall to it all the time. They fall to it. They fall to the dwarven rings. They fall to the dragon sickness. They fall to greed and to civil war and civil tension. And they're jealous of men and they're distrustful of elves. And they fall. They fall and they fall and they fall, but they fight. And the same is true of men. The men of Gondor have fallen and fallen and fallen, but they fight. The men of the north, the Dúnedain. The Dúnedain are the wrecked remnant of the kingdom of Arnor. They have fallen, and of course, the men of Arnor and Gondor, the wrecked remnant of Numenor, which fell. They fell. They fall constantly, but they fight. That might be the essence of what it is that makes for good, what it is that makes for virtue in the world of the Lord of the Rings, the world of Middle-earth. I hope that that's a full answer. I should mark that I was answering that, I guess. And that is probably going to do it. We're 15 minutes all over here. Nikki says, the proof is in the pie. Even with the Rings of Power, the dwarves were not easily corrupted. Well, the dwarves were not corrupted in the way that Sauron expected them to be corrupted. But they did kind of fall. The idea that the Dwarven Rings lie at the heart of the Dwarven hordes, that part of the Dwarven desire for gold was amplified by the ring, that there does seem to be a connection between the Dwarven Rings, the Dwarven lust for gold, and the dragon sickness. There does seem to be a connection between those things. Is it 3 or 4 of the Dwarven Rings that were destroyed by dragonfire? That's a very high percentage, you guys. That is like an uncommonly high percentage. What is the connection between Dwarven Rings and Dragonfire? Dwarven Rings lead to gold, lead to dragons, lead to Dragonfire. That's how you get dragons. Is that what you want? Okay. Good. Let's wrap it up there, guys. I think that's going to do it. I was really wanting to get to Boromir tonight, but it just was not in the cards, so we'll cover that all next week. Let me show you, in fact... Let me cancel that for just a moment and show you our next session. Next week, we're doing an afternoon session. Next week, we are not going to be meeting here at our usual 10 p.m. Eastern, 9 p.m. Central slot. We are, in fact, if I can cycle through these slides and get to the information so that I can tell you exactly, here we are. We are meeting next week at 3 p.m. Eastern on Thursday, October the 5th, 2017, at 3 p.m. Eastern, 2 p.m. Central, right here on Crowdcast. You can keep up with all of the latest Crowdcast information by going to crowdcast.io/pointnorthlive. You'll see the scheduled events there. You can head on over to pointnorthmedia.com, sign up for the newsletter. You can follow at pointnorthmedia on Twitter. You can head on over to facebook.com/pointnorthmedia. You can go pretty much anywhere on the internet and put in Point North Media, and you'll probably find something related to me. I think I have a Tumblr somewhere that I don't update, or I have a Tumblr somewhere that's automatically updating. One of those two things is true. Why not go forth and find it and tell me which is actually the case? Because if it's the former, then I probably need to fix something that's got broken somewhere in the code of my site. Next week, 3 p.m. Eastern, Thursday, October the 5th, 2017, we're going to look back on the Fellowship of the Ring. We'll take a little Q&A, and of course, we'll go through Boromir 2. Guys, thank you all so much for being here with me tonight. This has been an absolute blast. This has been an unusual pleasure tonight. It's just been a ton of fun. I hope to see you all there. I know. Jackie says, hope to see you there. I'll be out of town, but priorities. Jackie, you can do it. I absolutely believe in you. I believe you can do it. And if not, then the YouTube video will be available after the fact. The video will be uploaded to YouTube after the fact. And the podcast version, of course, will go out too. Then the following week, we're going right into the Two Towers and talking about the breaking of the Fellowship, the now broken Fellowship, and talking about the death of Boromir. That is going to be a really great chapter, so I hope you'll be able to join me for that. That will do it for tonight, though. Thank you so much for joining me. I will talk to you all again soon. Until then, take care.